All men think all men mortal but themselves, the poet said. But with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the situation is reversed. He knows he's going to die, but the other rabbis refuse to accept it. In 1954, the British Parliament sought to celebrate the 80th birthday of its Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, by commissioning a portrait of the man that would hang in the Parliament building. One of the most fashionable portraitists of the day, Graham Sutherland, was selected for the occasion. And yet the commission was, in a certain sense, doomed from the very beginning. As Simon Schama writes, all of Britain was wanting an image that would embody everything that Churchill had meant during the war. The national savior, without whose resolve they would have ended up like France, crushed by shame and occupation. The portrait Parliament and the people wanted was not just the likeness of a man. It was supposed to be an apotheosis of Britain itself, the finest hour in the form of the finest man. When this sank in, he writes, Sutherland knew that he could not live up to this cult of national salvation. All he could do, he kept on telling himself, was paint what he saw, end quote. In the end, Sutherland created one of the great portraits of British history. But he also gave us, in this painting, a mortal man overcome with age. He gave us what he saw. It was raw and uncompromising in its honesty. And Churchill hated it. He made it clear that he hated it. And today, the painting does not hang in Parliament or in the National Portrait Gallery. We do not have it. Only images and photographs, because Clementine Churchill ordered it burned. As her biographer put it, Clementine's work in the last few years of her life was all about protecting his, meaning Churchill's, legacy. Just as she was fastidious in promoting his career, so she did the same with his legacy. She saw that painting as not being the kind of heroic, warrior statesman kind of image she wanted to project. So she was ruthless about it. It had to go. And one of the masterpieces of our age was thus lost forever. The truth is that great leaders know that they are great. It is told of Churchill that he once was in a fight with his butler, and he said to the butler, you know, you were very rude to me. And the butler responded by saying, yes, sir, but you were very rude to me as well. And Churchill said, yes, but I am a great man. Now, the corollary of this knowledge of one's greatness is that for great individuals, acknowledgement of mortality and weakness and finitude does not come easily. When someone took Churchill's photograph on the actual 80th birthday, so the story goes, the young photographer, seeking to bestow a blessing on this elderly statesman, said to Churchill, Mr. Prime Minister, just as I took your picture for your 80th birthday, I hope that I merit to be able to take your picture on your 90th birthday. And Churchill looked at him and replied, I don't see why not, young man. You appear to be in perfectly good health. Truly great men often do not, or maybe cannot, ponder a world without them. Now, with this in mind, we in turn ponder one of the truly great and influential leaders in Jewish history, Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, known as Rabbeinu HaKadosh, or just usually Rabbi, or as I will be pronouncing it for most of this lecture, Rebbe. He presided over one of the few truly tranquil periods of Mishnaic Judaism, tranquil both within and without. As political leader, he enjoyed a good relationship with the Roman government, and as religious leader, he oversaw an age in which the personal acrimony of the past in the Beit Midrash that we have been discussing diminished. The different schools faded away, and a unified rabbinic Judaism came to be. He was wealthy, powerful, and pious, revered by all. And it was precisely because it was with him, and only with him, that one found in the Mishnaic period, Gedulah v'Torah b'makom echad, unassailable political and religious authority in one man. It was because of this that he, Rebbe, was able to achieve what would have been unthinkable for almost any other leader, the composition and compiling of the Mishnah as a central normative code for Jewry, ultimately adopted both in Eretz Yisrael and in Babylonia. Rebbe knew his greatness, The Talmud records his pondering the possibility of some of the laws of kings applying to him. A descendant of Hillel, and therefore a descendant of King David, Rabbi Judah the Prince was the closest Israel came in its leadership during the Mishnaic period to the restoration of the Davidic dynasty. And we are told that Rabbi Judah himself believed that the era over which he presided was so secure that he sought to abolish the ninth of Av. Yet, unlike many other leaders, Rebbe was known not only for his greatness, but for his humility. Indeed, the Talmud in Tractate Sota tells us that Mishamet Rabbi Bat La Anivut, when Rabbeinu HaKadosh and Rabbi Judah the Prince passed away, humility ceased to exist forever amongst the people of Israel. This line is then followed by one of the greatest and funniest lines in the entire Talmud, where Rabbi Yosef comments on this Mishnah by saying, Lo Titni Anivut, do not list this, meaning do not say that there are no more humble people, Di'ika Ana, because there's me. Leaving the ultimate meaning of that Talmudic line aside, the truth is, Rebbe was known both for his greatness and for his humility. And the greatest indication of his humility is that Rebbe balanced his honest understanding of his unparalleled achievements with an ability to imagine a world in which he no longer lived. And while this can be seen from several interesting sources, it is often missed that perhaps one of the most striking indications of this ability can be found in Avot itself. As we have seen in previous lectures, the first chapter of Avot lists from Hillel on the descendants of a dynasty, each succeeding the other as Nasi. This continues into the beginning of the second chapter with Rabbi Yudah Nasi. Rabbi Omer is the beginning of the second chapter, and that is the man that we have been discussing. Now, given what we know about the authorship of the Mishnah, the dynasty should end here, at least in Avot. Rebbe is the author of the Mishnah, so the dynasty in Avot should conclude with him. But if you look in Avot, you see that the dynasty continues. What follows Rebbe's Mishnah? Mishnah Bet. Rabban Gamliel beno shel Rabbi Yudah Nasi Omer. Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Judah the Prince, would say. Now, it is usually assumed that the author of Avot and the compiler of the Mishnah in general was Rebbe. But here, we are introduced to Rebbe's successor in the very Mishnah that Rebbe himself is supposed to have composed. This would suggest that Rabbi Yudah Nasi is listing his son as Rabban Gamliel while he himself is still alive. But there is one word that is intriguing, and that is the title accorded to this Gamliel. Not Rabbi Gamliel, but Rabban, which, as we have seen before, is the title of Nasi. Rabban Gamliel, of course, was not Rabban Gamliel. He was not Nasi as long as Rebbe was alive. Now, perhaps Rabbi Judah listed his son's title as Rebbe, and it was accordingly edited after Gamliel's ascension. Or perhaps Gamliel was added to the tractate after Rebbe's passing. All this is certainly possible. But there is another intriguing possibility, which is that this is indeed being written by Rabbi Yudah Nasi. And enlisting Gamliel as Rabban, and according the title of Nasi to Gamliel, it is Rebbe himself who is declaring Gamliel his successor as Nasi. For as we shall see, the notion that the future of the patriarchate lies with Gamliel was anything but obvious, and Rebbe himself may have wanted to stress this. What this would mean is that in composing and compiling Avot, Rabbi Yudah Nasi is describing his past and his future. And what he is giving us in this tractate is nothing less than his last will and testament. And this would be entirely in his character, because what is most striking about Rabbi Judah the Prince is that the man both understood his unparalleled greatness while simultaneously maintaining the ability to prepare for a world in which he no longer lived. In order to further appreciate how this is so, let us study the story of the last days of Rebbe's life and create a conversation between that text and these Mishnayot in Avot. Hopefully, the Mishnayot in the second chapter describing Rebbe and his successor, which seems superficially undramatic, will actually take on entirely new significance when read as the living will of Rabbi Yudah Nasi, and allow us to understand that one of the greatest moments of Rebbe's life was actually his preparation for his death. Let us see the Gemara. And this begins on Ketubot 103a, continuing all the way on to Ketubot 104a, we will only be looking at several small sections. I will quote both in Aramaic and in translation. Tanu Rabbanan, b'shat p'tirato shel Rebbe Amar. When Rebbe was about to die, he said, Libanai ani tzarich. I need my sons. I need my sons. Nichnasu banav etzlo. And so his sons came in to see him. Amar lahem. He said to them, he commanded them several duties, several charges. Hizaru b'chvodimchem. Be careful. Take care that you show respect for your mother. Ner yehe daluk bimkomo. The light shall continue to burn in its usual place, meaning a light that he would kindle should continue to be lit in its usual place. Shulchan yehe aruch bimkomo. My table shall be laid in its usual way and in its usual location. Mita tehe mutzad bimkoma. My bed should be made in its usual location. Yosef chofni Shimon Efrati, Heim Shimshuni B'chayai, Veheim Yishmshuni B'moti. These two individuals, Yosef Chofni and Shimon Efrati, who attended me in my lifetime, shall attend to me when I am dead. This is the opening of the tale. And Rebbe here is saying to his children, do not forget me. Remember me in my death. Allow my presence to continue to fill my house. And the Talmud takes this quite literally, later suggesting that for some time after his death, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi continued to visit his family on Shabbat until his visits were discovered. And then, so as not to cast aspersions on other sages who did not attain this form of spiritual immortality, he ceased his own visits as well. Now, however literally one understands this, what is taking place in this deathbed command is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is essentially telling his children, as a father, I am dying physically, but I will not leave you. And his instruction, Ner Yehiyah Daluk Bimkomo, the candle shall be lit in its place, ends up serving as the source in Jewish tradition for the Ner Neshama, or what is called the Yahrzeit candle, the kindling of a flame in recognition of the fact that a beloved family member's presence still remains after his or her passing. Now, in these few words, therefore, Rabbi Yehuda's message is personal. It is patriarchal. Rebbe has two sons, and he is speaking to them as their father. But the political question, the religious question, the national question of which one of them will succeed him is not discussed with them at this point. He had no doubt discussed the matter with them before, but it doesn't come up at this point. It is as if Rebbe understands that that is a conversation that belongs not to his family, but to the rabbinic leadership. And that is who he sends for next. And thus the story continues on the bottom of Ketubot 103a. Amar lahen, l'chachmei Yisrael ani tzarich. He said to them then, I now need the sages of Israel. Nichnasu etzlo chachmei Yisrael, the sages of Israel, entered to see him. Amar lahen, he said to them, al tispeduni ba'ayarot. Do not eulogize me in the small towns, meaning have one centralized marking of my passing. V'hoshivu yeshiva l'achar shloshim yom. Do not mourn for me excessively. Continue the regular Torah study after 30 days, after the end of my shloshim. And then he gets to succession. Shimon b'ni chacham. Shimon, my son, that's his younger son, shall be the chacham, meaning he will be the halachic authority. Gamliel b'ni nasi. My elder son, Gamliel, will serve as nasi. He will be the political representative and authority. Chanina bar Chama yoshev barosh. And Chanina bar Chama, that's a student, not a child of Rebbe, will oversee the yeshiva. He will, as it were, be the Rosh Yeshiva. That is the passage describing his conversation, not with his children, but with the sages of Israel. And so much is taking place in these few words that we have to pause to unpack them. In the Torah itself, two deaths stand out, that of Yaakov and that of Moshe, Jacob and Moses. Each is striking, and each is distinguished from the other by who is present at the moment of death. Jacob is the patriarch par excellence. Unlike Isaac and Abraham before him, all of Jacob's children follow his spiritual path, and Jacob's death appropriately occurs with him surrounded by his children. Now, Moses also has children, but we do not see them gathered with him on the mountain before he goes up to die. His instructions are to Yoshua, to the Kohanim, to his spiritual and political successors. It's as if Moses' position and responsibility have, throughout his life and at the moment of his death, separated him from his family, taken him away from his children. We meet, in other words, Jacob as father, Moses as leader. Now, Rebbe is both. Rebbe is father of a great family, descendant of a great family, but he's also the political and Torah leader of a nation. And he understands that his success as a human being and his life being considered one that is well-lived lies in his properly balancing these two aspects of his identity. And this is something very few leaders achieve. Many strong leaders are terrible parents. At the same time, there are fathers who allow the love of their children to impact improperly at times, perhaps, their own leadership decisions. As a descendant of David, Rebbe knows both the dangers of allowing the personal to impact the political, as David was so often influenced by his own feelings for his children, but he also knows the central theme of the story of Solomon, who succeeded David, that one's legacy is defined by recognition of one's mortality and the appointment of an appropriate successor. But to make that proper choice, Rebbe cannot see himself as a father, but as a leader. He needs to reverse the way most human beings see themselves. He needs to be part of a nation first, and only secondarily as part of a family. And thus, Rebbe announces the future of the leadership, not to his sons, not to his family, but to the sages. He recognizes what many leaders who are also fathers do not, that the choice of his successor pertains first to the nation he leads, only secondarily to the well-being of his children. And the latter, however difficult, must be subordinated to the former. Now, with this in mind, we can notice something striking about the structure of Avot, one on which I have seen no one comment. Hillel appears twice, first in the first chapter of Avot, and then in the second chapter of Avot. Why does he appear twice? Because there are two forms of succession and transmission being described. Hillel appears in the middle of the first chapter, and then the rest of that chapter describes his descendants, his biological progeny. Hillel, as we'll discuss tomorrow, then appears again in the second chapter, followed by his student, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and then followed by Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's five students who will go on to impact learning for generations. Meaning the second chapter is thus devoted to Hillel's non-biological intellectual progeny through Rabbi Yochanan. It would ostensibly have made much more sense for the first chapter, therefore, to contain Rebbe and his son. After all, that's part of the same physical line. The first parak should thus have continued with Rebbe Omer, and then Rabban Gamliel. Then we break, and then a clean, separate chapter would start with the intellectual line of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, with those who are not the actual physical family of Hillel. But that is not the structure of Avot. It is Rebbe who begins the second chapter, perhaps in order to recognize that he sees himself as a bridge between the two. If he has power and religious authority, it is because he has unified within himself the power of the Nasi and the Torah of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rebbe, the author of Avot, recognizes that he is part of a family and the leader of a people. And he has to balance those two. He has to bridge those two. And it is as a leader, not a father, that he has made a decision as to his successor. From the perspective of familial continuity, the inheritance of all titles in one individual best serves the family interest. That is why primogeniture was the watchword of European nobility. Rebbe's oldest son is Gamliel. He should inherit, based on this logic, all of his father's glory. Yet Shimon, the second child, far surpasses the first in scholarship. Now, Rebbe could bestow all his positions on Shimon, but he clearly believes, as the Talmud will tell us, that Gamliel does have certain moral qualities that will allow him to excel as a Jewish political leader, both in Israel and as representative in the Roman courts. He thus decides to divide the position. Gamliel will be the Nasi, the political representative to Rome, political leader of Israel's Jewry. He will get the title Rabban. But the halachic leader, the Chacham, will be Shimon. Shimon b'ni Chacham, Gamliel b'ni Nasi. And his reasoning is explicated in the Talmud, which asks, obviously the firstborn should inherit the leadership. Says the Talmud, Hakra ka'amar, and this is 103b in Ketubot. Hakra ka'amar, it's an explicit verse in the Bible. Ve'et mamlacha natan Yehoram, ki hu habachor. The kingdom was given to Yehoram, because he was the firstborn. So obviously Gamliel should become the Nasi. Says the Talmud, Hahu memalei mekom avutav hava. Yehoram was able to succeed as the firstborn because he was the equal to the father who had come before him. But, says the sages somewhat starkly, for Rabban Gamliel, eino memalei mekom avotav hava. Rabban Gamliel was not, in terms of Torah, equal to his father. So the Gemara then asks, okay, for Rebbe, my time avid hachi. So if that's the case, then why did he make Rabban Gamliel Nasi? He should have made Shimon Nasi, if Gamliel was not his equal. De'eino memalei mekom avotav b'chokhma. B'yirat chet memalei mekom avotav hava. Answers the Talmud, even though he was not the equal to his father in wisdom, meaning in Torah, when it came to Yirat Chet, when it came to fear of sin, he was his father's equal. And therefore he was made Nasi, because fear of sin is the most important virtue for a gifted Jewish political leader in the Roman world. Thus he has decided to divide his titles. Shimon b'ni Chacham, Gamliel b'ni Nasi. And having declared this decision to the rabbis, we are told that he now calls his sons back, but this time separately. First he says, I need my younger son. Rabbi Shimon comes in, and he gives to him what the Talmud calls the orders of wisdom. Then he asks for his older son. Rabbi Gamliel enters, and he is entrusted with what is called the orders of the patriarchy, meaning of the political leadership. And it is striking that in every description of the succession, Shimon is mentioned first. Shimon is called in first because he is the Torah successor. Torah supersedes politics. But then the political heir enters, and he is the one, not Shimon, who is made Rabban. And yet, despite this title, Gamliel, son of Rebbe, does not appear much in halachic texts. His brother Shimon is everywhere, learning with his father, teaching the next generation. But that perhaps is why Gamliel and not Shimon has to be specifically in Avot and in the description of the succession of the dynasty. And perhaps it is Rebbe himself who puts him there. When he, Rebbe, is still alive, puts Gamliel there with the title Rabban as instruction that the future political leader is Gamliel. And the juxtaposition of the last part of Rebbe's own maxim in Avot with the name of his son that follows, Rabban Gamliel, is perhaps itself deliberate. With what maxim does Rebbe leave us? Yistakel b'shlosha dvarim ve'ein ata ba lidei aveira. Reflect on three things and you will not come to sin. Da mala mala mimcha. Know the three things that are above you. Ayin ro'ah ve'ozen shomat v'chol ma'asecha ba'sefer nichtalim. Know that above you is a seeing eye that perceives all, a hearing ear that hears all, and a book in which all your deeds are written. Or more literally, all your actions are written ba'sefer, which means in the book. The maxim, in other words, is about what the Talmud, in discussing Rebbe's death, calls Yirat Chet, fear of sin. What Rebbe is saying is the most important. Fear of heaven and fear of sin. Knowledge that all we do is recorded and that we are accountable for all our actions. And immediately following that maxim, we are introduced in Avot to his successor, Rabban Gamliel Omer. If Gamliel was placed there by Rebbe, and especially if he was placed there with the title Rabban, then we are being told both that Gamliel is to be the Nasi, the political ear, and also through Rebbe's Mishnah, we are being told that it is because of the importance of Yirat Chet that Gamliel is chosen as Nasi. Avot, understood this way, communicates Rebbe's last will and testament. And even if Rabbi Gamliel was placed later by someone else after Rebbe's death, it still stands in juxtaposition to Rebbe's maxim as an explanation for why Rabban Gamliel was chosen as Nasi. But if Rebbe himself put it there, then it communicates something larger. In Avot, as in the tale of Ketubot, Rebbe communicates that he is prepared to contemplate his own death. And that is what makes him remarkable and unique. Thus, the English poet Edward Young once reflected, all men think, all men mortal but themselves. Themselves when some alarming shock of fate strikes through their wounded hearts the sudden dread. But their hearts wounded like the wounded air soon close, where past the shaft no trace is found. As from the wing no scar the sky retains, the parted wave no furrow from the keel, so dies in human hearts the thought of death. Even with the tender tears which nature sheds over those we love, we drop it in their grave. And so if this is true about human beings in general, it is doubly true, usually, about powerful leaders who change the world they lead. To read about Roosevelt, FDR, is to be struck by the fact that this frail but enormously powerful man, who was very, very ill, gives every thought to winning the war and redefining the world order, but no serious thought to the possibility that he might die at any instant, and that his vice president will define not only the nature of his legacy, but the future of the world. When one reads American history of the 1940s, one is struck by the fact that Roosevelt does not really seem to care all that much whether his vice president is Henry Wallace or Jimmy Byrne or Harry Truman. And only a man who does not conceive of the very real possibility that he can die 4 months into his fourth term does not give the choice of his successor any real thought. It is terrifying to consider that had this very sick man died a year earlier, Henry Wallace, a Soviet sympathizer, would have been president of the United States. FDR did not imagine an America without him. And that is actually a flaw in his leadership, but one very common in the most impactful of leaders. Churchill, in a somewhat similar sense, found himself at the age of 80, refusing to retire, refusing to make way for the next generation. The savior of England could not imagine that the country did not still need a savior, and he could not imagine that there was a savior other than himself. As Sharma notes, Churchill's famous quip that he knew history would be kind to him because he would write it himself came home to him when he contemplated what the story of his last years would look like to those who would chronicle it after he was gone. He himself was at work writing the later volumes of the history of the English-speaking peoples. After the brutal shock of rejection by the electorate in 1945, his second prime ministership, beginning in 1951, came as vindication. It also had come at a time when the terrors of the Cold War and Britain's uneasy position between the United States and the Soviet Union had become unsettling. Though Churchill had resigned himself to the hard fact that henceforth America would be very much the senior partner in the alliance, he fervently believed that there was no one in British life, certainly not his likely successor, Anthony Eden, who could navigate a course between the superpowers with as much authority and experience, wisdom as himself. So when a new and even more apocalyptic weapon, the hydrogen bomb, was tested, Churchill saw himself as indispensable to the fate of his country and indeed the peace of the world. And this, Sharma notes, is why an honest portrait of Churchillian mortality could never be embraced by the prime minister, however expertly it was executed. As he writes, "For all these reasons, the face that would appear in the portrait assumed a significance well beyond that of a birthday present. It would be an image of his body politic, the rock, as he told the painter when he started the sketch." Sutherland later remembered that Churchill repeatedly and indiscreetly told him about the maneuvers against him in the cabinet and his party, and the ill-advised efforts to get him out of the way, affronts he took personally as well as politically. In fact, Churchill grumbled constantly to Sutherland during their sittings about the attempts to push him out of number 10. Churchill may well have thought to himself, he, meaning Sutherland, is a clever man. He will understand what is needed here. But the painter had a political tin air. He just carried on sketching. That the portrait had now become a crucial weapon in Churchill's resistance to his own demise didn't occur to him. The painter saw Churchill as a man, in other words. Churchill needed to be seen as an immortal rock of ages. When we study the story of Rebbe, a contrast emerges. Here it is everyone else, his disciples, the rabbis, not he, who refuses to see Rebbe as a man. Rebbe has already given the rabbis instructions about what to do following his death. He is telling them, "I am about to die." But the rabbis hear him, and they do not listen. And this leads us to one of the most heartrending stories in the Talmud. This is the top of Ketubot 104a. "Hahu yoma denach nafshei de Rebbe." The day that Rebbe died, as he lay dying, "gazru rabbanan tanita." The rabbis declared a fast. "Ubay rachame," and they prayed. "Va'amri," and they said, "kol man da'amar nach nafshe de Rebbe yedakar becherev." Anyone who says Rebbe is dead will be stabbed by a sword. They were cursing anyone who said the words Rebbe is dead. They are basically outlawing, using their Torah authority, to forbid Rebbe to die. Rebbe cannot die. "Slika amte de Rebbe l'igra." And the handmaiden, meaning the maidservant of Rebbe, went to the roof and she prayed. Originally she prays for Rebbe to survive. "Amra," she said, "Elyonim mevakshin et Rebbe v'atachtonim mevakshim et Rebbe." Both the heavens seek Rebbe and those on earth seek Rebbe. "Yihi ratzon she'achofu tachtonim et elyonim." May it be the will of God that those on earth overcome those in heaven. But, continues the Talmud, "kevin dechazei kama zimnei de'ayel lebeit hakisei v'chalatz tefillin." When she saw many times that Rebbe had to painfully remove his tefillin to go to the bathroom to relieve himself, and she saw the pain that Rebbe was in, she changed her mind. And she goes up to the roof, and she prays, Amra yihi ratzon she'achof elyonim et hatachtonim. May it be the will of God that those above overpower those below. And as the rabbis continue praying incessantly, she takes a jar, shakla kuza, shadya me'igral ara, and she threw that jar from the roof to the ground. The shattering sound startled the rabbis. They paused their prayer for one instant, and then the soul of Rebbe was taken. The literary imagery is itself incredible. There's a tug of war between heaven and earth. The tug of war is over Rebbe. The humble maid first sides with those on earth, but then she ascends up to the roof and joins the forces of heaven to help them. All men think all men mortal but themselves, the poet said. But with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the situation is reversed. He knows he's going to die, but the other rabbis refuse to accept it. A world without Rebbe is unimaginable. The future of Judaism in the land of Israel without Rebbe is unimaginable. And they are not wrong to be worried. Rebbe himself knows that no one of his children can succeed him. No one of his children can be him. And that the Torah world, the Jewish world, will be entirely different when he is gone. But he will be gone. All men are mortal. Rebbe is a man. Therefore, he is mortal. But the rabbis go to war with heaven to ensure that this does not occur. The only one who understands that this cannot be is a maid who sees her master first and foremost as a human being rather than a Torah leader. She sees a man in pain. The rabbis see a Torah world that is about to disappear, and they cannot let go. Rebbe also knows that he is mortal. Like the maid, he knows he is mortal. But the rabbis do not. And when the maidservant wins and Rebbe dies, and the rabbis suspect that the worst has happened, even then, most could not bear to face the fact that Rebbe might be gone. And so they have to pick one of their colleagues from amongst them to see if the unthinkable has occurred. And so the Talmud tells us that they said to Bar Kappara, go see what has happened to Rebbe. The Talmud tells us that Bar Kappara went and saw and sees that Rebbe's soul has departed. He tore his garments and then went to the rabbis and said, the angels and the mortals were grasping at the holy ark. The angels overpowered the mortals. So they said to him, has his soul departed? Meaning, are you telling us that Rebbe is dead? And Bar Kappara responds, you said it. I did not say it. Now, Bar Kappara, whom scholars today have identified as Rabbi Elazar HaKappar, is the one who is chosen as the only one who could bear to witness that Rebbe is dead. And here too, perhaps, Avot helps us to understand why this is so, why it was Rabbi Elazar HaKappar who was chosen to see. It is interesting to note, as Ben Ilau notes, that to Bar Kappara, to Rabbi Elazar HaKappar, is ascribed the following Mishnah at the end of the fourth chapter in Avot. Rabbi Elazar HaKappar omer, Hakinav ha-taiva ve-kavod, motzin et adam min ha-olam, and then he concludes, Hu haya omer, he used to say, Hayuladim lamut va-metim l'chiyot va-chayim ladun, Leida ul-hodiya ul-hivada, Shuhu keel ha-yotzer, Hu ha-borei, Hu ha-mevin, Hu ha-dayan, Hu ha-eid, Hu baldin, Hu ha-tid ladun. Those who are born will one day die. Those who die will live again, and the living will be judged. It is for us to know, make known and confirm that he is God, he is the maker, the creator, the discerner, the judge, the witness, the plaintiff, and he will deliver the judgment. And then he concludes, Va'al yavtichacha yitzrcha sha'ashol beit manoslach. Don't let your evil impulse persuade you that the grave is a place of refuge. Shal krochacha tanotzar val krochacha tanolad, val krochacha tachai val krochacha tamet. For without consent you were formed, without your consent you were born, without your consent you live, and without your consent you will die. And without your consent, you will in the future have to give an account of your life before the Supreme King of Kings. This is the maxim, this is the mantra of Bar Kappara. He was known, in other words, for facing the fact of human mortality. So perhaps that is why he was chosen. If anyone could come to grips with Rebbe's departure, it was he. Yet he too cannot speak of Rebbe's death explicitly, even though he has seen the body. Despite yourself, you die, says Bar Kappara. But even the man who says those words cannot say the words, Rebbe is dead. The only one who could see Rebbe as mortal was a maid. But that is not quite true. For another person could also see Rebbe as mortal, could also envision a world in which he no longer lived. And that was Rabbeinu HaKadosh himself, Rabbi Dan Nasi, Rabbi. And the ability of this great man to see himself as mortal is part and parcel of his greatness, and it sets him aside from almost any great leader in history that has lived. In the end, the rabbis were right to fear what would occur after Rebbe's death. The golden age would not continue, and the center of all that is exciting about Torah, the center of Torah leadership itself perhaps, shifts to Babylonia, to Rav and Shmuel. But Rebbe was right to recognize that this day would come. Rebbe's life and his death loom large in the Jewish imagination, and it captures something important about how we see our leaders, how we as Jews see our leaders. It's interesting to note that today Jews have reestablished a Jewish polity in the Holy Land with a security unknown since the days of Rebbe, and greater than that still. And it's fascinating that Israel's history contains many grand photographic moments, such as Ben-Gurion's Declaration of Independence, Begin and Sadat at Camp David, the funeral of Yitzhak Rabin. Yet none of these looms as large in the public mind as more humble photographs. David Rubinger's soldiers standing not as warriors, but humbly and reverently as subjects of the divine at the Western Wall. And even many of the most beloved photos of Israel's political leaders show them less as statesmen than as vulnerable human beings. A great deal of them taken by Rubinger. Golda Meir washing dishes and feeding her grandson. Menachem Begin, one of my favorite photos. Menachem Begin devotedly placing a shoe on the foot of his wife, Aliza. These are photos that actually involve juxtapositions of greatness, of majesty, and humility. And for Judaism, we seek to join these two, and we seek leaders who join these two, because God joins these two. Makom sha'ata motze gvurato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, gedulato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sham ata motze an v'tanuto. Where you find God's greatness, there too, says the Talmud, you find his humility. And if it was anyone who imitated God in this respect, it was Rebbe, a rabbinic leader of unparalleled power and greatness, who also personified humility in a remarkable way. And that, as much as his Torah, that is part of his legacy. The Talmud reports that the signal used by Rebbe to announce the new moon, to announce the glimmer of light that had appeared in the darkness, was David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. King David still lives. On the one hand, this phrase describes the glory of Rebbe himself. Rebbe, who was the closest Mishnaic Jewry came to a monarch. Rebbe, who was himself a descendant of King David through Hillel and through Hillel's dynasty. At the same time, we know that the biblical parallel for this phrase, describing the immortality of David, appears when David lies on his deathbed and is cognizant of the fact that he is about to depart the world and thinks long and hard about his successor. And upon selecting Solomon, his wife Bathsheba proclaims, Yechi HaMelech David LiOlam, may King David live forever. Implicitly saying that now that he has recognized his mortality and is prepared for what is yet to come, David is thus ensuring his immortality as well. It is the recognition of his mortality that is part of Rebbe's immortal legacy. And that is why we can say of him, the master of the Mishnah, what we say about his ancestor David, that Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the great master Rebbe, Chai V'Kayam.